welcome to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half hour. And this week's episode is entitled Missing Persons. Been kidnapped. We're talking about films in which they're centered on a character that is considered missing in the film. Now, I'm not going to lie, it's a very similar episode to what we did a couple of weeks ago. We talked about characters who get kidnapped. I'm not sure what's in the water at the moment at my place, but it seems to be an area that I've been interested in, partly because one of the films we're going to be talking about this week was recommended by one of you dear listeners, so we thought we'd give it a crack. That will be the first one we're going to talk about this week, The Vanishing, the 1988 film by George Sluzer. But it is going to be a slightly different episode to the one we did on kidnapping, because I suppose that week was more about the relationship or the dynamic between the kidnapper and the kidnapped, and specifically like that dynamic of taking someone away from their home and the ethics around that and the attitudes towards that. Whereas this week we're probably talking more about like kind of like the vacuum or the deficit that ensues when someone goes missing specifically. And I think it's focused a little bit more on the person who's actually kidnapped, or the space that that creates when the person goes missing themselves. And to be honest, not all these films are actually about people getting kidnapped. Sometimes people simply go missing, which in and of itself is its own thing and might have some symbolic significance, I think. But let's actually talk about the films we're going to talk about. As I mentioned a second ago, we're talking about the 1988 film The Vanishing by George Sluzer, and that one's had a bit of attention recently. I know a lot of people like Commode, and a lot of people have been talking about how it's one of the scariest endings of all time. It's a pretty intense film. Then we're going to move on to a personal favourite, which I did mention when we did the kidnapped film, which is Denis Villeneuve's 2013, what I think is a bit of a masterpiece, Prisoners. It's personally my favourite film of his, which is saying a lot because he's a fantastic director. And then we're going to finish off with a new one, directed by Sean Price Williams, The Sweet East, from 2023. And I cannot recommend this film more. If it's at a cinema near you, please go see it. This one is topping my list in terms of films that I've seen in recent months at the cinema. Absolutely loved that film, and I'm very excited to talk about it. It was just a very interesting coincidence that it coincided with this week, with talking about missing people, because we've been doing The Vanishing for a couple of weeks, and I thought, oh, it was quite synchronistic that they're all sort of lining up, so that's nice. But let's get started now with Mr. Georges Sluzer's 1988 film, The Vanishing. So if you're not familiar with the film, we basically got a boyfriend and girlfriend go on a road trip. They stop at a pit stop, and the girlfriend goes missing. And then for the rest of the film, the dude is basically spends his entire time looking for her, and it involves this kind of sinister and fairly long interaction, which comes kind of the focus of the film, with the man who, let's say, is most likely responsible for where she's gone and what's happened to her. And I think to kick things off this week, let's talk about this one in how it depicts the kind of, I'm going to use the word intoxicating. I don't mean intoxicating in the sort of sense of like, you know, when someone's seductive. But, you know, when you ingest poison, it can sort of seep into you and break you down and slow you down. The kind of intoxicating nature, or the sort of poisonous nature of what you might call a lack of closure, right? Not having certainty around something that's of particular importance to you. And so in essence, the protagonist is unable to move on. It's not even that he was that close with his girlfriend, even though it sounds kind of a bit horrible. You know, they weren't married or anything. The sense of not knowing the answer to the mystery, the feeling we have when we watch, you know, an Agatha Christie miniseries or something, we deeply want to know who did what, even though it might not have any significant bearing on our lives. That lack of knowledge, that deficit of knowledge, is something that can have an extremely, can bog us down quite profoundly. And it basically, there's an interesting paradox in the film where it basically comes to the point where the protagonist is essentially given an offer to essentially risk everything, and I mean that in sort of the most basic sense possible, to find out the answer. Essentially, does he give up everything to find out one thing? And so it's a paradoxical idea, because it lifts up this notion of, you know, is it worth giving up one's life in order to rid ourselves of the pain of not being able to move on and live our life. So, you know, the anguish he feels comes from the fact that he can't move on and live a life. Is it worth giving up that same life in order to find out the truth about the thing that's not allowing him to live his life? So there's a paradoxical nature. He's kind of doomed either way. He either can't move on because of the grief and the lack of closure, or he has to essentially risk that thing that he can't do in order to find out, in order to rid himself of the thing that's keeping him, you know, in order to grab the keys to his life, he has to give up the thing that he has to. And it's a similar film we talked about as the Tarkovsky film, The Sacrifice, many months ago, and the idea that true sacrifice involves giving up the very thing that you would fight for in the first place, and there's a sort of a paradoxical element to that. And it does introduce us with it to an idea that's going to kind of run through a lot of the films we're going to talk about this week, which is that, especially the next film we're going to talk about after this, which is that you could say that losing someone else is a worse experience than being lost yourself. And because you're the one that has to live on with it. You have to live on with that grief, or live on with that sense of mystery that is intoxicating, that does bog you down. And this can apply to a lot of things. I think probably the best metaphor that this film serves as is a metaphor for sort of existential angst. And you're living in an uncertain universe where we can spend our only years that we might have in this very short blip that we have on this earth trying to determine whether one's life is worth living, or how it's worth living, and how we can live a meaningful life, how can we live a truthful life, all the while one is not living that life truthfully or meaningfully in searching for that sense of truth. One could be reading books constantly, not enjoy what, you know, what if the meaning of life is to enjoy spending time with family or to enjoy the sunshine, but you're spending your whole time in libraries or on the internet trying to figure out what the true meaning of life is, and that sort of thing. And I think that's a really pertinent example when we consider the symbol of this film is based on a book called The Golden Egg, which of course I haven't read, but there's the girlfriend in the film has this recurring dream of being trapped in this golden egg, which is a bit like being buried alive in a coffin for her, because she can't get out. It's this feeling of being within sort of, I think the golden element has almost got this almost like a divine aura or halo around her that she can't break out of, and it's complete darkness where she is. And she actually references this when she's in a dark tunnel in the film, and at the beginning of the film, and a truck is coming down, which is sort of symbolic of, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel in a way, of a kind of very kind of morbid or mortal piece of imagery. And she mutters under her breath, "The golden egg." So there's certainly imagery of mortality. And I think there is a sort of existential edge to this film, which is to say that, you know, the grief one feels in not knowing the answers to life's big problems, where the girlfriend is sort of a symbol for the absolute, be that truth or meaning or God or whatever. And this boyfriend is willing to forego a meaningful life, or a truthfully, or a true life, or a truly good life, in order to find out what that meaning or what truth actually is paradoxically foregoing those things. Or foregoing the application of those things in order to find them in the first place. But this sort of paints him as sort of the aggrieved party, and, you know, he's essentially been taken out of his own life, much like the girlfriend herself, to be sort of a victim of this deficit, to be a victim of her going missing. Can it ever be the case that that person is actually, you know, they're not the aggrieved person, but they sort of become they become as almost as bad as the person that's responsible for this whole thing all to begin with? Well, before we move into our next film, just remind you are listening to Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the remainder of this half hour slot. Please stay tuned for more quality radio content here on 2XX, and also consider jumping onto our website if you're not there already to sponsor the show or to subscribe to the station. But moving on now to Mr. Villeneuve's 2013 absolutely thrilling, what I think is a modern masterpiece of cinema, Prisoners. Basically, we've got two little girls who go missing in, I think it's in Pennsylvania, and the main parent we're going to focus on is Hugh Jackman, who's one of the fathers of one of the daughters that goes missing, and the cop that's looking after the case is Jake Gyllenhaal, and sort of one represents law as it is, which is Gyllenhaal, and Jackman sort of represents, you know, taking justice into one's own hand. And there's certainly do the means justify the ends paradigm, sort of philosophical contemplation in this film. And how they interplay with each other and who actually was the good guy and who actually gets results and da, da, da. We're going to specifically focus on, there's a really interesting aspect of the film. It's particularly explored through, probably best explored through the bad guys in the film. But this idea of, if you can say that, it's kind of a silly thing to say really, considering what we're about to sort of say about this film. But basically I want to talk about this film and how it explores this idea of kind of radicalization as a result of what we've been talking about. We've been talking about missing people kind of being symbolic of an unfair deficit. I guess you could say in just broader terms of injustice, how one can so easily be radicalized when there's a huge gap or huge deficit in their life that they didn't ask for, that they didn't earn. There's just, you know, if you look at the average person, they're living this kind of life and you have this huge hole in your life and there was no reason for why you have it, but suddenly you have it. What do you do about that? Well, it sort of seems like radicalization is kind of like a ironclad consequence of that reality. So the logic of the bad guy in this film, if you haven't seen, I'm going to try and be very vague about who they are, what they did, and why they do it. And I got to say, like, when you watch a film like this, it's very rare that the logic of someone doing something as evil as what they do makes sense. You're kind of like, oh, especially when there's a lot of horror movies and stuff like that, they're like part of like a cult or something, like it's a bit like superstitious and you're like, what's going on here? It's a bit weird. But this film works so well in terms of the logic of the bad guy, and we see it play out so perfectly, so well paced throughout the film. But essentially there's a kind of Cainist, Cain in the sense of like Cain and Abel from the Bible view of life and God. That's how the villain sort of thinks in this film, which is that they kind of have this view that injustice, unfair injustice, sort of just being having a deficit thrust upon you out of fate, brings about an inevitable hatred of life and God, and you go to war with God. And this is very similar territory to The Vanishing, I think, where the survivor of the missing person almost faces a worse condition than the missing person themselves, because, you know, the loss of the person is. And we could sort of say, also, I should sort of mention, when you lose a child, for example, lose someone that you love, it's kind of symbolic of maybe the worst experience one can go through. I think you could use such exaggerated terms, because it's not like you're the one who goes through this sort of short-term period of suffering. It's the sort of thing that you know, you're losing someone or something that you care more about than yourself. Maybe the only thing in the whole universe you care more about than yourself when you lose it. So, first of all, it's worse than losing yourself in that sense. But also, you have to live with the pain moving on. Whereas at least the person who goes missing, you know, maybe potentially they die instantly. And that's it. So you could sort of talk about these films as, how do people deal with this vacuum, which is symbolic of the worst imaginable pain that someone could go through? Anyway, going back to this idea of going to war with God as a result of that, having this sort of Cain versus Abel, shaking your fist at fate, shaking your fist at the universe for putting you through something that seems to be like arbitrary punishment, which is sort of just the human condition, isn't it? We all come out of the womb with all sorts of grievances that we didn't ask for. I mean, no one asked to be alive to begin with. Yeah, terrible things happen to all of us. But it sort of seems like a kind of cultish idea a little bit at the beginning of the film. We're like, who are these kind of crazy, superstitious, weird cult people? It's kind of like a conspiracy theory. But then when we follow the lives and experience of the people in the film who lose someone, who are suffering from having their children being taken away from them, we see so how it's so seamlessly easy to fall into this state of total, what you might call wrath, against those who we can't necessarily prove to be at fault. Like this feeling of wrath just seems like such an inevitability, despite the fact that we can't always justify it. And I think that's kind of why I love this film so much and why I think it is such a masterpiece, is that is really one of the deepest, most eternal truths about humanity, I think, which is something we've talked about a lot on the show, which is the road to hell is not paved by a sense of pure evil. You know, that these people, that, you know, the people who do the worst things in history don't do it because they just get out one day and like, I just hate the world, just, you know, just because they wake up that way. It seems to come from a place that these characters, you know, we empathize with them because when we look at their experiences, these terrible things that have been done to them happen just out of chance. They don't choose to wake up and have this as a reality. And if you accept that life can dish that sort of thing up, you can't help but think like you do all sorts of things to rectify that, especially if the people that are suffering are people that you love. They're your children. We can kind of sympathize with why these characters do such crazy things. And so while the beginning of the film, this idea of war against God or war against life seems like a bit of like a quirky superstitious idea, by the end of the film, it's kind of proven to be a fairly rational thing to do, to commit evil, to commit wrath on people. It's very much like a film like David Fincher's Seven, where we're taken to a place where people are just in simply unfair circumstances. Terrible things happen to them, and they have no choice but to be sinful. It's and that is the eternal truth. And I suppose that's where things like an Augustinian or Catholic kind of idea of original sin comes from, which is that there's a point in your life, inevitably, where you're cornered into a place where you're going to... Sin is an inevitability. You have no choice. There's nothing... Those are the parameters that have been set for you. And so you kind of have to go to war with God, in a sense. You have no choice. Once that's given to you, you have that... There's almost no choice. Evil is your only path. And so that's why the film's title, I think, is so pertinent, because it's not simply that, you know, the girls were prisoners, and this seems like an obvious thing to say, but when you watch the film, all of these characters are essentially enclosed into a state of what you might call extreme anguish. And for some, that results in extreme violence, where they have no choice. They are imprisoned in a cell of evil. They have no choice other than, to be evil. It's the only way that they can progress their situation to somehow get out and save the people that are truly innocent and grieving. So, or in a state of anguish. So, on one hand, with The Vanishing, we sort of have a sense of sympathy. We see a sort of tragedy in the character who's burdened with being the survivor of a missing person. But then in Prisoners, we get to a point where we say, well, it's very easily, while we should be sympathetic with that kind of person, and I think we should, we can't simply just see them as a victim, because ultimately they are the same people that turn into the evil people who do terrible things. They have action. In fact, they have no choice other than to be evil. And they become so evil that they can actually perpetuate the very injustices that put them in that situation in the first place. So we have to be very careful about the emotions that we import or that we map onto those kinds of people, because they're almost simultaneously victims and perpetrators of the same thing. It's almost like this chain that, because there was an original sin or there was an original injustice that took place at the beginning of this thing, of this story of life, as long as injustice exists, it will persist because it's almost infectious. It intoxicates and we can't help but engage in this cycle. Well, I don't know how true that is, though, because let's have a look at another film now, third and final film for today, that might advance this question a little bit further. The Sweet East, directed by Sean Price Williams. And as I hinted at the beginning of this episode, I love this film so much, and not because I agree with it. I saw myself in characters in this film. I cringed at it. I thought, I don't want to be that guy. This was a perfect cinema. When the film ended, I was like, oh, I'm glad I finished at that point. I was with you, Sean, every second of this film. I had a philosophical epiphany watching this film. I loved it so much. Basically, we've got the protagonist, Lillian, who is played by Talia Ryder, who's on this like high school excursion to Washington, D.C. So from the beginning of this film, we've got this backdrop of Washington, D.C. being the sort of epicenter of political power in America. And then she's swept up into this kind of odyssey that traverses her through all of the, what you might call sort of all the modern radical groups of modern East Coast America or America more broadly. And the fact that it's called the Sweet East and it is really ostensibly about America, I think actually is quite poetic. So as to say that sort of the East Coast is kind of synonymous with the agenda setting for the USA, like that's where DC is. It's also close to New York and that sort of thing. But I think the film starts in DC and kind of ends with a sense of Americana. I think that's kind of the point, which is sort of to say that, you know, there is an epicenter of ideas or agendas that comes out of the Sweet East, and what is America but a runoff of what happens in DC sort of thing. I don't want to get into it too much, but it's interesting that the focus is on the East Coast of America rather than America itself. It's not called the Sweet USA, for example. And so there's this backdrop of DC from the beginning of the film. And the first two films we've talked about have all been about, you know, what's the experience of the person who's aggrieved when someone they love goes missing, and how can they be sort of radicalized and turned into someone terrible? This film subverts both of those ideas and says, well, hang on, can we actually look at this from the perspective of the missing person? And so when Lillian gets swept up by these groups, she becomes sort of like a missing person, and there's questions about whether she's been kidnapped for her family and stuff like that. And we track her. What is the experience of being missing? can, you know, and there's almost like a paradox element to that. You know, if we're with her, is she actually missing? Well, she's technically a missing person. And sort of we get to see this sort of insight of what's the experience? What's actually happening when a person goes missing? And so I think, given that this film comes out in 2023 and what happens and the fate of this character in the film, I think what the film serves as, at least for the purposes of today's conversation, is it depicts modern society itself as a missing person. So we've been talking about the sort of the victims, you know, the aggrieved parties who have to live on, the surviving parties of a missing person. I think this is this, well, hang on, we're all a little bit missing, aren't we? Right? In the same sense, in The Vanishing, there's this sort of sense of existential dread, and in Prisoners, we're all sort of trapped in the state of inevitably having to do things that are evil. Sort of saying that, like, we're all a bit lost, aren't we? We're all in a place of not having footing where we want to have footing, where no one's in the place that they want to be, right? We're all far from home a little bit. And why I think this film is particularly powerful is not just a story about someone who's sort of wandering around the world with no idea where they're going. They are they're grazing by, or they're having these brief little dances, or they're sort of indulging or participating in very briefly and temporarily, giving all these four or five different radical groups a little taste test. It's almost like while we float around in a state of kind of aimlessness, it's not that we go nowhere, it's rather that we're tempted to fall into some of these more radical buckets, and the sort of four are the kind of like the Antifa sort of artivist kind of people at the beginning, then you've got the right-wing white supremacists, then you've got the very kind of overly indulgent bourgeois, you know, they wouldn't call themselves bourgeois, but that you know, that inner city artist, that sort of obnoxiously indulgent artist type, and then we've got kind of what you might call a, in quotation marks, religious militant group at the end. And the Lillian character, I think, is so well done and so well performed, where she, in that sense, she's the every person, right? The person who is, you know, all of these radical sort of outlets are made available to her, and she has to contemplate whether she fits into any of them, and how she's going to get out of them, and that sort of thing, and where she sort of fits in that radical state of affairs. But I think she's a little bit more complicated than that. Just enough. There's an extra little sliver, a little sinew, that little layer, a meniscus of complexity to her character that I think just gives this film a little bit of an edge, where she's not simply a blank canvas. She has a bit of lethargy about her, and she does get swept up a lot. That's a phrase you might use about this film. She gets swept up into all these groups, but somehow she kind of keeps her nose in front of all of them. It's a very 21st century sense of coolness, I think, where she's just sort of above all of these. She's able to sort of wriggle out of all of them. And it's not just because the movie needs to progress. It's interesting what her character does in each of these situations. And I think this is quite notable because I think Williams does a really fantastic job in this film of simultaneously emphasizing all of the absurdity of these groups. So they're not hard to resist in that sense, because they are absurd. But it doesn't create caricatures of them either. It makes them look absurd and silly, but none of these characters are characters that you've seen before. They're fresh. They are straw men in a sense, but they're new. They're not the caricatures that we know. They're not the two-dimensional memes that we think of. So the Simon Rex character is a really interesting example. I don't think I've seen a film where you've got a sort of academically or intelligent, intellectual, hard right-wing white supremacist in a film. I can't think of a film that does that. In a lot of ways, it's almost a very dangerous idea, but the film still works. He still looks absurd despite him being sort of very book smart. And by the way, Simon Rex, who fans of the show know I love Red Rocket and Sean Baker's film, and I think Simon Rex is so good in this film. But it's a character that it's still, despite the fact that it's new and it's not as two-dimensional as we've seen before, it's still absurd. And so it's not so much that the film has to, and this is kind of my main point, I think I'm trying to get to you, is that it's not so much that the film has to straw man these radical characters. What's really important about, I think, what this film says is that these characters, even if they're not straw men, they're still inherently absurd regardless. And so it still remains open to us as the every man or the every woman or Lillian to weaponize something about herself as an individual, as a three-dimensional person, to maintain composure, to overcome them, to be that kind of 21st century cool that's looking ahead of the curve. And kind of had that street smart, or she weaponizes things like her street smarts or sexual appeal, her charisma, a bit of courage, a bit of savviness to always get ahead of these groups. She's never truly threatened by them at any point. She's able to get in front of them at all points. And by the end of the film, she's a very cool person. I couldn't help but feel that, not just in the performance of Tyler Ryder, but in the facial expressions of the final shots of the film and the music and what's happening. There's a sense of that we can get in front of this thing. So it is a very depressing film, I will say that. Like, it's not an uplifting film, but I think her character itself is somewhat empowering. It gave me a little bit of hope, actually, in that kind of coolness. She's sort of up to the challenge, I think partly because... I don't think you see that kind of character. She is quite bold, particularly in some of the language she uses. Like, she doesn't fit into the modern box. I think she does sort of sit a little bit ahead of the culture as it is, which is what good art should do. I think the closest film I can think to a film like this to compare it to is something like Beau is Afraid, for example, which has that kind of odyssey being swept up in the craziness and the chaos of the day. And I think these would be great. It would be a great double feature. But I think in that case, you know, Beau is Afraid, Joaquin Phoenix's character is a bit of a victim. But in this film, Lillian, she sort of gave me this feeling that, you know, there may be hope for the next generation. They're kind of up for the challenge. It's a very huge and terrifying, scary mountain to climb, what they have in front of them. But she sort of seems like there is, you know, there are things available. There are things in one's arsenal to get ahead of the radicalism that could cause some pretty extreme danger. So to look at all three films together now and compare them and sort of highlight their differences. The first two films kind of focus specifically on the grievances of those who have to live with this deficit of having a missing loved one. And Prisoners goes as far as to say that deficit can bring one to become quite radicalized in and of themselves. And that's why we have things like radicalization, you might say. But in The Sweeties, it says, well, even if that is the case, even if there is almost like a steel man one could craft for the radicalized in this world. I think it's what it kind of posits, this idea that that even though this experience of modern society, you know, it is one of a person who is lost in and of themselves, we're still able to, you know, we're still up for the mission here to sort of find some kind of inner courage to sort of stick our nose out in front a little bit and get in front of these very radical groups, even if they threaten something very, very terrible, all three or four of them that are potentially knocking on the door here. So looking ahead, I do kind of wonder whether we'll see films, the next film in this sort of category, where the hero is able to somehow resist radicalism through a kind of radical common sense-ness, a kind of coolness, a kind of pragmatic relationship with society, where the protagonist, our hero, doesn't subscribe to any kind of bold ideology, but simply just maintains a sense of coolness in being able to see past these little groups and their groupthink. But in any event, I think what is common in all three of these films is that we do place a great value on the lost souls in each of these films. We never really feel a sense of wanting to protect and value them, those who have been swept away by powerful malevolent forces, which might be something worth seriously remembering if we're ever the ones that go missing. Thank you so much for joining us this week on Sacred Cinema here on 2XX98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I've been your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, and please stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX, or jump onto our website to consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show. Also, you can get in contact with me. You can email me at contact@jimmybernasconi.com for any more recommendations like The Vanishing, and we'll see you again next week. Have a good one. Cheers.